Recording. It's even better than I could have imagined. That was responsive. Good morning, everyone. On this beautiful, sunny summer day. Hope all is well with everyone. I just want to alert folks to the fact that we are not only being recorded, but we're live with CTN. So we do want to make sure that we are following our normal protocols, but in particular, which I'll get to in a minute, but just to introduce myself, I'm Brendan Sharkey. I'm the chair of the Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations. We have our vice chair, Lyle Ray, with us, and our intrepid staff person who keeps us all honest, Bruce Witchen. This is the our regular monthly meeting for Friday, August 6th. I wanted to alert you all to, again, to the fact that we are live, but in any case, if you would like to be recognized to speak, please use your raise hand function or otherwise wave wildly at the camera and I'll recognize you. Let's see, with that, I think we'll move on to our, we have a pretty full agenda today. So we'll kind of move right into it. The first item after our call to order is the approval of our draft minutes from the July 9th, 2021 meeting. Do I have a motion? Marcia LeClerc is a motion and Jim is a second. Do I have any discussion on those minutes? Or recommendations or changes? If not, seeing none, I'll call for a vote. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye, giving a thumbs up, however you choose to.
Aye.
I think we're unanimous on that, if I'm not mistaken. So those minutes are, in fact, approved. All right, so item three. On our agenda generally is a discussion of a number of the reports that ACIR now is in the middle of. Willingly or not, we have certain mandates that we have to abide by statutorily, and we've also taken on a few of our own reports and studies. So with regard to our statutory and legislatively required reports. We do have, as our usual place marker that Bruce puts in the agenda for us, the session mandate report, which is due in November. And then we also have the mandate compendium supplement. These are items that are regularly required of ACIR to produce for the legislature. And I know, Bruce, you put this on the agenda so that we keep it in mind and it doesn't sneak up on us at the last minute. But, you know, as you've indicated on the agenda, there are some questions that we really should be asking of ourselves. Whether we want to, for example, as you've identified on the agenda, do we want to do a deeper dive into the annual report on mandates? Specifically, did the impacts of those mandates match the predictions that might have been alleged at the time or that they were adopted? And do we want to also look at how different mandates affect different municipalities differently? I don't know, Bruce, if you want to add anything more to that, and maybe should we be thinking about scheduling something to or a working group perhaps to discuss that topic in a little more detail.
Let me turn my camera on here. Honestly, I think the ACIR has either been assigned or taken on more than enough things to work on between now and the end of the year. I will keep those questions up there. More than anything, I think to just be a prompt and a reminder. I'm working my way through this year's public and special acts. I think I'm about a third of the way through. I'd be happy to respond if there are any questions, but if you were to consider creating a subgroup to tackle those things, you may want to wait until the other report is done at the beginning of the next legislative session. That could be a good time to focus on such a thing.
Great. Okay. So we'll await the efforts that you're undertaking now to kind of put all that together at the very least. And then we can try to explore those questions that you're raising as to, should we make some changes to those reports to make them perhaps a little more robust and relevant for the folks who are reading them. Any other comments or thoughts on that before we move on? Thanks, Bruce. If not, let's move on to the, other statutory report that has been assigned to us via section 154 of the implementer. This is the study of remote meeting access and also remote voting requirements that is being proposed, that was included in the implementer and is now proposed for implementation by law as a requirement of municipalities. Our charge specifically within ACIR is to work with the Freedom of Information Commission, the Association of Municipal Attorneys, as well as the Chief Information Officer to form a task force to evaluate the recommendations that the legislature made elsewhere in the implementer on remote meetings and voting, and report back to the legislature by February 1st of 2022. At our last meeting, I think at that meeting I was sitting in a Dunkin' Donuts parking lot because my power was out. But if I remember correctly, what we were discussing in that context, with Lyle sort of leading the way, was to establish somewhat of a task force on among those other organizations to kind of develop a framework, basically, for how we would go about tackling and evaluating what it is that the legislature is proposing. To that end, at the last meeting, I had said that I was going to reach out to the other organizations to kind of see if we can get a meeting organized, an initial meeting organized, which I've done. Haven't heard back yet from the Chief Information Officer. Thank you to Bruce for advising me that now the Chief Information Officer is housed in the best division of the Department of Administrative Services, as opposed to having previously been housed in DOIT, the Office of Information Technology. I've reached out to them, haven't heard back from them, but FOIC is definitely interested. They have a couple of staff people. Well, they need to be more than interested because they're statutorily mandated to participate. So, FOIC got back with a couple of staff people who are very dedicated to this very topic. And as have the municipal attorneys. What I was hoping to do is to at least get an organizational meeting together before the end of August, before Labor Day. I realize vacation schedules and such are may come in conflict, but if we could at least get organized within the month of August, we can really start launching into this in earnest come September. I've kind of taken that on as my charge as chair, but obviously it's very important that other members of ACIR, particularly those who have a particular interest or expertise in this area, also participate in that discussion. So if folks are want to be involved in that, once I get an organizational meeting together, I'll ask Bruce to send that out to everyone. And, hopefully folks from ACIR can participate. Lyle, I don't know if you have any other thoughts on that or, okay. Any other comments on that in terms of the organization of it or focus or what have you? Okay. That's a lot of work that's going to be involved. So the more folks that can participate, the better. Hopefully you all can help out with that. So now we're going to move to item four on our agenda, which is the LGF initiative, the Local Government of the Future initiative. For those in the public who may be watching, we as ACIR have taken on a role. This, I think, is what Bruce was referring to earlier as taking on a lot of a lot of work for ourselves. But this is a topic that members really felt was important for us to work on, which is the question of to what degree is the term home rule either misunderstood or misapplied in municipal settings these days generally. This is not meant to be a treatise on the history of home rule in and of its, the legal history of home rule, and but rather a baseline understanding of what really we operate under as under the, our statutes and under our constitution, and then apply those specific guidelines and parameters, constitutional and otherwise, to specific examples of that have practical application in the municipal setting, and oftentimes are misunderstood with the public and with others who may think we have, a municipality may have more or less authority to act on these particular topics than they actually do. So we dedicate now our standing monthly subcommittee time, which happened this month to fall on, I believe it was on the 27th of July, to take on individual pieces of that topic. And the first meeting that we had on the 27th was a summary provided to us by Attorney Steve Mednick, who probably is the statewide expert on charters, home rule, constitutional limitations on municipalities, who did give us a summary of where the law is and what the law is on this topic. Those meeting notes that Bruce has put together are available to you all as and to the public as a summary. I don't know if anyone had any comments on that discussion that happened on the 27th. I thought it was particularly helpful and a good launching point for us.
I agree.
Thanks, Margaret. Yep. Mm-hmm. Any other comments on that meeting? Okay. Well, what our the thought has been, I think, to take the accumulated minutes that that occur for each one of those meetings at the subcommittee level and assemble them towards an ultimate report that we would offer to the Planning and Development Committee prior to or just after the start of the 2022 legislative session. So we have a baseline now, thanks to Steve. He's also going to produce what I think will be a one-page summary of that of those legal boundaries, so that we have that as a baseline. The next meeting that would take place on of August 24th, if I'm not mistaken. I may have a conflict with that particular day and time, but we can talk about that a little bit later. Will be to talk about the application of the guidelines that Steve laid out for us as to what home rule and local control really mean, and apply it specifically to municipal finance, the general topic of municipal finance, such as what towns can do in terms of raising revenue, what are their limitations locally, how do they actually carry out certain financial functions as a body of the a creature of the state. And we have a couple of folks who I think may be able to participate, one from the Municipal Finance Officials Association that Martin has been able to put us in touch with, and also someone that John Filczek actually has worked with over the years, who's expressed an interest in participating as well. I don't know if you guys have anything to add on that. I kind of get the feeling that because CTN is carrying us today, that there is a little, folks are a little camera shy.
Hesitancy?
Yeah, right. There you go.
On the finance side, I would be happy to be part of that. You know, as first selectman, part of my responsibilities is to manage the fiscal office and work directly with our board of finance for a small town government's finances. So I think I can bring a little to that.
Thanks, Bob. Yeah.
And Brendan, Rick Porth, CCM, you had asked at the local government of the future meeting if CCM could help out. I think we can. So we'd like to be part of that discussion, and happy to work with you on that.
Great. Thank you.
That's great, because it adds extra, you know, staff here, basically.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's great. John, can you remind me too of the gentleman that you had referenced? I know we talked briefly about after the meeting about the person that you were identifying.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance to talk to him, so I don't really want to put him on the spot before I've had a discussion.
Yeah.
But he has experience in both in the small town, a larger community, and in the corporate world on the finance side. So I think can bring three perspectives and a lot of experience, worked at length with us extensively with our COG. And so I think he's got a unique perspective, and I want to speak for him or identify him at this point, but I think he would be more than happy to assist us. And I'm looking forward to hearing from him on the 24th.
Great. Great. And if folks can kind of, you know, mark that on their calendars with particular questions as well. I know, you know, Bob has offered a couple of examples by the way, Bob Valentine, who's the first selectman of Goshen, has offered a couple of examples of situations that he's run up against where there's some confusion about what authority the town has to carry out different functions on the financial side, as well as, you know, what differences there may or may not be with regard to the different forms of local government, be they RTMs or boards of selectmen, or you know, in terms of budget adoption and other types of things. So in any case, we'll come prepared for that discussion on the 24th. So moving on our agenda, if there are no other comments on that topic, further on our agenda is other old business. Item A under old business is the discussion of what we're doing and where we stand with the policy studies that we've undertaken with UConn and with the University of Georgia. Lyle, do you have any updates on that?
Yep, I passed over to Rick Porth at CCM the three studies that have been completed, and we're waiting for timing of the release of the CCM report, and we'll follow up with webinars on that. The other piece is we have gone ahead with a September 23rd webinar, even though it's only slightly related to ACIR, on the juvenile justice and car theft issue with a number of police chiefs and chief elected. So we're going to have that at noon on the 23rd of September. And we've confirmed Jay Williams as a moderator. We have the West Hartford police chief as one of the presenters. And so we will get everybody a link if you're interested in that. So right now we've got the three studies over to CCM, and we'll coordinate any webinar follow-ups when the CCM report is released. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Terrific. Thanks, Bob. And Rick, do you know when the timeline, how the timeline is looking right now for that?
I do have a little bit of an update. We will meet next week to strategize more on the rollout, and we know that we want to coordinate with ACIR's work in that rollout, and we will certainly circle back with Lyle and the larger group when our own plans become more solidified.
Great. Okay. All right. Thank you both. So with that, we'll move to 5B on our agenda, which is an update on the fact that the Institute for Municipal and Regional Policy has been moved in the most recent budget that's been adopted from Central Connecticut State University to UConn. I wanted to let folks know on ACIR that we did have a conversation with Professor Al-Qadri last month, just discussing what his plans were with the assumption of that institute into his department. I think it's fair to say that those of you who participated in that discussion, or feel free to jump in, but I think it's fair to say that Professor Al-Qadri was, I think, caught a little bit off guard when the legislature decided to make that change. I don't think that was something he was expecting to happen or planned on happening. And as a result, I don't think he had a clear idea or full idea of exactly what to do with that, but was very interested in having further conversations about the role that the Institute might play under his auspices. I also think that conversation with Professor Al-Qadri also led to some other conversations about what John Filczek and others have been raising, which is the fact that in past meetings, in other states, there are, like Massachusetts, there are, I don't know if you want to call them institutes, but let's, for the sake of this discussion, refer to them that way, that are housed in academic settings that are readily available for municipalities that actually do the study and analysis work that's necessary for issues as they come up in real time for municipalities. And the question has been raised whether this is something that perhaps a newly formulated institute at UConn, that might be a role that this could take on in somewhat of a partnership, frankly, with ACIR. I'll hand it over to John in a sec, but I mean, I think one of the things we're even seeing it in today's agenda, that we're looking into a lot of issues and recognizing our role and our function as an ACIR, but also recognizing that we as a group have limited bandwidth, that Bruce does tremendous work on behalf of our commission as our staff person, but you know, that's a limited resource. And if there was some form of academic institute or resource that could partner with ACIR as a function of what we do and what municipalities need in interacting with state government, maybe this is a place to house that. And on the last point I'll make is that in addition to this institute having been transferred over to UConn, I think there may be an opportunity in decisions that will be made starting next month over the course of the fall and voted on by the legislature. There is some additional federal money that it may be on the table to help jumpstart some of this as a concept. And perhaps we also can take advantage of the timing of this to see if there might be some opportunities that we can follow up on. So I'll stop talking. John, you had your hand raised.
Yes, thank you. And I think they probably did, the legislature did catch UConn off guard with the transfer. And it'll be interesting to see how they see that fitting into to the university. But I circulated after that meeting a link to the old program review and investigation site, and which maybe would be good for everybody to see, because I think that's the kind of, and that truly to me was one of the great mistakes this legislature made in the last decade, was the elimination of program review and investigations. And in an ideal world, if ACIR had that that type of horsepower that program review and investigations had to address, take deep dives on these subjects, I think would really be what I envision of having that kind of that robust horsepower to do research and investigation, not in an academic setting necessarily, but in a real world setting. And I think if folks take a look at the work that PRI did, and it's all out on that web link, you'll see that they took deep dives in just a huge cross section of issues impacting Connecticut, and made recommendations. Unfortunately, many of which were not taken up by the legislature, but I think fit right in with our mission. And I don't know if there's a way to recreate PRI going forward, but it would be my vote to do that. So I think it would be maybe instructive or helpful if people could see that link, and because obviously they're not in business any longer, but that work is still very valid and holds true, and I think is a model for what we might try to attain, whether it's through UConn or through as a maybe as an arm of ACIR and OPM. But that's what I want to put out there for discussion.
I just add to that, Mr. Chair, and then very quickly. I wasn't able to join the first conversation with Professor El-Khadri, but IMRP is providing the briefing and the background materials for the September 23rd webinar on juvenile auto theft. So they're already being that resource. So they're doing it already. To your point, John, they're jumping in and offering that kind of assistance pronto. So I think your suggestion makes a lot of sense, but they're not sitting idly by. Ken Barone from IMRP is going to be providing the factual trend background on juvenile auto thefts and what has been done on juvenile justice in the last decade. So just FYI. So I'm sorry, Jim has a hand up.
But if I could just jump in on that, because I think one of the true strengths of PRI is they have the Program Review and Investigations Committee. And take the, you know, look at the example of ACIR, which identified studies, identified priorities, and they went ahead and did that.
Yep.
Didn't necessarily get, not that there's bureaucracy at UConn, but doesn't get mired in that. It was the committee said do this, this, and this. And that was their work product, and they took it on and did it. And I think it worked quite well. It was a tremendous resource to the General Assembly.
Yep. And bipartisan. Yep, bipartisan. Yep.
I'm not sure if that would work through an academic, you know, whether it's UConn or Yale or whoever. It's just sort of a different animal. Mm-hmm.
You have
firsthand experience with it, Brendan, but more than me, obviously. But
Jim, just if you could bear with me for just a sec. That was my first chairmanship in the legislature, was to chair the Legislative Program Review and Investigations Committee. Yes, it was a bipartisan committee in that it was made up equally of Democrats and Republicans, senators, House members. Chairmanships flipped every 2 years. It's one of the few committees that a Republican could actually chair and did chair each session. And as John indicated, it was a tremendous resource. It was created by statute and had a statutory function. It also had at its height at least 8, if not 10, professional researchers who had their own background expertise on particular topic areas, who'd be assigned to one or two of them, would be assigned to each study, and the studies would be recommended by members of the legislature and others, and then voted on by the committee to take on. And then the staff would take a full year to actually do all the research and, you know, that was involved. It was a deep dive that the committee would take on. After my term as speaker, I was always a big champion of PRI. After my term, my successors, thought better of the, and I think budget constraints were such that, the cost of retaining that level of professional, high-level professional staff was viewed as not necessary in the context of difficult budgets. I think that decision was short-sighted, but at the same time, I think it's fair to say that the recommendations of PRI, while valuable and, continue to serve as a resource, were often ignored. I have to say it. It was not treated seriously, I think, by a lot of legislators as the valuable resource that I think it is. And that, unfortunately, meant that it wasn't as sexy an item for the budget, and it was an easy target for budget cutters to identify, to take $1 million off the budget when they needed to. So anything of that kind that might be recreated, I think has to be pretty well focused. I think it has to be well funded, and it also has to be relevant and perceived as relevant by those who would be the recipients of the studies and the work product. Because if it's not, it fell into disuse because folks didn't really see it. Part of it was the way the studies were conducted. They were not in sequence with the legislature. And so oftentimes recommendations had to wait 6 months or longer to actually be implemented. I mean, there were a number of functional dysfunctions within PRI that I observed as I went on in leadership, which was frustrating. But I think there are lessons to be learned from the demise of PRI that if we were to recreate it, we should perhaps try to rectify. Jim, I'm sorry, I kept you waiting. And you need to unmute, Jim.
Thanks, Brendan. Sure. Yeah, what I was thinking when this came up about the PRI committee, harking back to our first item of business, the discussion about the mandate's impact and doing that cost comparison between the actual cost and the projected costs, I was wondering, would that be something that, that typically perhaps could have been an item that this group would take up? I guess that would be my question.
I'll let other folks comment, but I think that is a fundamental problem with ACIR, right? Because there are a lot of topics and a lot of issues that we do want to take on, and we have limited bandwidth to do that. And I think this gets to John's point, which is that, you know, as good, you know, Bruce outlined what the difference in our agenda, you know, different aspects of the mandates report that we might want to consider. But we're relying exclusively on Bruce to put that together for us, unless we all kind of chip in and roll up our sleeves to sort of help out. And yeah, some kind of adjunct or partnership or some relationship that ACIR might have with OPM, with UConn, with CCM, and others, I think would make ACIR more effective.
Yeah, I agree. I agree very much. There have been, I think, two problems in the last probably 10 years or more of ACIR's existence, and the lack of bandwidth, as you call it, the lack of staff to be able to do these deep dives and produce some results has been very much lacking. The second thing you alluded to is an overarching problem, and you mentioned that, well, program review and investigation perhaps wasn't, the reports weren't heeded and recommendations weren't followed. I would say ACIR has the same problem. We don't seem to get anywhere, even when we produce terrific reports. And so I think that's, for me, that's a focus that is a high priority for us, is to try to figure out, you know, how to get more of the legislative leadership involved so that they actually will take up some of these issues and follow along with the recommendations. That would give us a lot more enthusiasm, I think, because if we thought we were generating some results in the long run, we'd be much more inclined to work more quickly on these subjects, I think.
Agreed. That's why if you noticed my evil plan last fall to propose some legislative changes, right? That speaks directly to your point, Jim, that we were successful in getting really what I view as a major legislative initiative off the ground in terms of reformulating the RPIP grant to be more proactive and more effective in terms of the programs, regionalizing programs in a more effective way. You know, that was designed in part to also bring attention to what ACIR's mission actually is. But again, you know, that's only one initiative. And Jim, I think you're right that if we can be bringing more attention to the work that we do by increasing our bandwidth and our ability to do more, that will happen, I think.
I've perceived over the years that ACIR is, I don't know whether you'd call it bipartisan or nonpartisan, but ACIR really, we don't seem to project partisanship as it relates to the issues. And so I'm not sure whether with the legislature that's a good thing or a bad thing, but I've always thought that was a benefit, a good thing for this commission.
Agreed. Margaret.
And I would second what Jim said. From my experience, this is an excellent group of people and whatever, and no matter how much staff you had, they wouldn't pay attention to you sometimes.
Right. So with that that downer from Margaret, John, did you want to follow up?
I do think, and related to this in terms of bandwidth, and, you know, the fact that we have part of Bruce's time and, you know, in his comment at the beginning that perhaps we ought to be looking for going into the next legislative session, of the use of, and it's in our February report from a year ago or wherever it was in 20, was to use some of the funds from that are in that, I'll call it RPIP, but it's the wrong term, so that we can get some additional staffing through the Intergovernmental Relations Division at OPM dedicated to the work of ACIR, so that we can increase that and not have it all fall onto Bruce, who's doing other things as well. And it would be a rather modest sum. And I think that's would enhance our ability to do our work.
Well, you're segueing seamlessly into the next item on our agenda, which is the federal funding and the governor's recommendations regarding ARPA. I mean, I know that there will be a special session in the fall where the legislature will weigh in on funding, federal funding that will be available for a whole host of issues and needs. And, you know, you're raising the question, I think, as to whether this group should be really considering something specific in terms of an ask. And maybe it's in the context of the UConn assumption of the Institute. Maybe it's in some other form, maybe perhaps with CCM or with some other context and cost. Should we be formulating the thought of how to staff up or at least partner with another entity that would have the staff and bandwidth to be able to do some of the things that Jim's talking about, Margaret's talking about, I think we've all talked about over time. What's the thought on that, Bob?
And I would agree, but I do want to circle back around to staff that we have currently and just make clear that I think Bruce does an outstanding job for the time that he has available for us. And I'm continually impressed. So thank you, Bruce. But yes, it would be helpful to be able to move some of these things forward. We all have other things that we do. And although we may have strong interest in things, we don't necessarily always have the time to dedicate an in-depth dive into some of the issues that we see as being important.
Right. Right. If I haven't already expressed the admiration and appreciation of Bruce's work, let me make it clear on the record that I and I think everyone else on the commission echoes Bob's comments on that. I have to do this because he's at least on screen, but the undersecretary of OPM is a participating member of ACIR. And I think this is, I think it's appropriate, Martin, if you can offer some perspective on what we're talking about here. Do you think that's something that is worth pursuing, or is, knowing what you know about the deliberations on
the state and government level? Good morning, everyone. Thanks, Brendan. So
you're welcome.
Yeah, put me on the spot. Sure. No.
Sure.
So, there's a couple options. As we know, just kind of back a little bit, some of the original things when the governor took office, there were some proposals, ACIR's, proposals about trying to, add some staffing into our unit to be able to support ACIR better. Obviously, none of that has come to fruition in the budget process. There's one aspect there of, do you look at a modification? Obviously, there's nothing in this budget cycle, for any increased staffing, for ACIR. So that's something that could become as a midterm budget piece. One of the problems with the ARPA funding is very difficult of hiring any permanent staff through that funding. More of it is consultant. We're finding that as we go through looking at broadband proposals, other things of that nature, where they don't want it being unless it's replacing, you know, staff that you had to let go. There are some provisions that way, but because this would be new staffing, it would most likely have to be more on a consulting basis that you could request the funding for, and look at it that way. So that would be, you know, a suggestion in that sense, that you look for a consultant over the next 2 years to help do some of these reports, get things going. And then maybe, you know, in the next budget cycle, you propose to make those permanent, you know, type of an employee. That may be the approach to go looking at it for funding, to get some initial funding there for it. Additionally, and I know we talked at the previous sub-work group meeting, but under Public Act 19-117, Section 229, no, I didn't remember that, I have it written down, there was $250,000 appropriated in that budget, basically to promote and facilitate the implementation of the most effective, high quality, cost-effective, and responsive service delivery for that. Those funds are still there. They have not been used yet. More of it is looking at, you know, what should they be used for? As we've talked about earlier, the switch over from UConn to CCSU should, you know, possibly funds might be able to be used for that. Could it be something that we could utilize those funds for this? And then obviously it's got to go through the secretary for the use of the funds, but there's another small pot of money as well that we might look at, whether it be for consultants or something, you know, for this regional service, you know, delivery area. So those are my thoughts on it.
Boy, Martin, I'm glad I asked. I mean, that's, you know, that's, so the comments you made about staffing and full-time staffing versus consultants and the issues related to that were also raised by Professor Al-Qadri as well. Within the confines of his operations at UConn. So that's helpful. And I, you know, so that's consistent, but those additional funds, I think are an interesting thing to consider. But yeah. John, mm-hmm. I see you have your hand raised.
So if we're going on to the coronavirus state fiscal recovery fund issue on the agenda, is that where have we shifted onto that now?
Well, we're talking about the ability of ACIR to staff up.
If we're not onto that agenda, I'll wait. But it seemed like we shifted to starting talking about the state plan.
You mean under 5C with regard to the ARPA funding?
Yes.
I did segue into that because I was making the point that perhaps there's an opportunity to make an ask under ARPA funding to, you know, either fund the Institute at UConn or through some other source.
Because if we're onto that, I have something else I just want to raise.
Since
this is an intergovernmental issue.
Sure, sure. If I could just put a pin in that for just 1 minute and then while we finish up this staffing discussion first, and then John, John Filchek?
I just think on that it is worth pursuing whatever option might be the most viable of, and I'm in full agreement, you know, Bruce, it's amazing what he does with a limited time, but beefing up the support through OPM for ACIR, I think would be on a short term, whether it's a budget adjustment, however that might be, ought to be something we pursue. What the specifics of that are, you know, we need to flesh out rather quickly. And then, you know, we have the other piece of it where I brought up PRI, UConn is in there as well. But I think whatever we do ultimately needs to be nimble enough that if this body decides, you know, wishes to study in a certain way, that we're not subject to whatever the constraints or the whims are of a third party. So that if you see what I'm saying is, if we want to study local government, this or that, that we have the staffing or the relationship that we can get that done. And it's not, okay, we can do that in 3 years, or we'll do that, but we'll do that sort of different than what you're looking for.
Yeah, I see.
And I also, just while I'm doing that, is I think the more that there's a relationship directly with this group and not with a third party that may also be pursuing, have its own agenda, what have you, however valid it might be, I think similar to PRI and what they were, and that committee, which was bipartisan, nonpartisan, well, it was partisan at times, but bipartisan in approach. When you look at the makeup of ACIR, it is quite broad. And so I think we have to be very careful about those relationships with any funding. So if that makes any sense. But I think absolutely we should pursue something, both in terms of the sort of the staffing of this group and that research element.
Right. Can I just, yes, Margaret.
Yeah, I just wanted to cheer on ACIR because you have this fantastic opportunity to do right, do good for, let's say, 100 of the towns that are have charters and all that kind of thing. And this is something people want to hear about. So I think you did a great job getting that opening for us. You.
Great, thank you. Yeah. Before we leave the topic, I think it's maybe valuable. I definitely think it's valuable to hear from Bruce as our staff person. Bruce, do you have any thoughts on this as far as, you know, not only the limits of your time, not your skills, but your time? And with this, do you think this might be helpful if we were to pursue something like this?
So I am put on the spot. It would not hurt to have more staffing capability to deal with things. I think even ignoring providing more staff, that it's possible that, like, making changes in some of the mandated reporting, whether it's about mandates or something else. The ACIR made a significant change in the mandate reporting format a couple years ago that made a dramatic change. There would be no way that I could be dealing with subcommittee and all these other things right now if not for revisions to the mandate reporting process made then. I think any further changes to that process probably would be more incremental. But, so it's partly looking for additional help, but also, as always, finding the most effective way to use available time that we have now.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you for letting me put you on the spot.
And if I could just add one other thing, I would hate that going forward, if we look to do something and get some legislation in there, and then a fiscal note comes through that says that it's going to cost the state money, and we lose the ability to do something because we get a negative fiscal note because we don't have the staffing that we need to have to back up what we're trying to do. So just a little protection as well.
Sure. Lyle, yeah.
Muted.
You're muted.
Oh. I'm fighting with it. Thank you. Just to hark back to the governor's transition team, we anticipated additional resources to help in that process. So this is not a new thing. This is something that goes right back to that, you know, years ago. And so that would make some sense. The other piece of this is, I think, threading the needle between what's internal capacity in OPM and what is done at UConn and IMRP is another one. The university is very used to using consultant academics to do studies. That's a typical way they operate. So just something to keep in mind as we proceed. But this is not out of the realm of experience of Professor Al-Qadri in sort of commissioning studies related to what ACIR is doing. So just to let you know, they're quite familiar with that. It's somewhat less common in state government, but very common in the academic world. So but those are my two thoughts. This goes back to the transition team, and then UConn is quite well aware of how to do commissioned short-term studies. So, Mike, thank you.
Yeah, that's a great point. Right. Well, let's maybe we can have some conversations with Martin, with Professor Alcadre, with others, those of you who are interested in just, you know, see if we can have further discussions about this, but do it sooner than later, because I think, you know, if it is a matter of funding that might be related to this ARPA money coming in, we would want to make that ask, if you're prepared to make that ask. Shortly after Labor Day, because that's when I understand leaders will be meeting to have those conversations. If it's something else that, you know, in a different realm that might be funded differently or from a different source, then, you know, then maybe the pressure's not on as much in terms of timing. But we should probably continue this conversation sooner than later and move on it sooner than later. Marcia, yeah, you're muted as well.
I'm just wondering if asking for money without identifying how much we really need is the reality. Should we identify those kind of topics that we really want to deep dive into up front and then work with them so that there's some correlation and tie-in with short-term objectives but long-term benefits that will need some legislation possibly? I'm just thinking that if we don't identify those which we want to take up while we're asking for the money and see some type of ability to be seen as independent and as part of a solution, a longer term solution, maybe we won't be seen as an adversary to trying to do our own agenda aside from this legislative body. And that's the political aspect that I sometimes see come into play here, that I really think we should be conscious of what we take up and how much money we need to take that up and really come to a resolution or a really finite ending on that topic. That's just my thought.
That's a great thought.
Only because I feel like we spin our wheels so much trying to get information and it doesn't go anywhere. So if there's specific things that we want to take up and there we can get funding behind it because there is a long-term objective that we can work hand in hand with other entities for and the legislative body as the support behind it, I think we need to identify that.
That's a great thought. All right. Well, let's agree to reconnect and have a further conversation on this before our next meeting, if that makes sense. So thank you all for that input. John, you also wanted to talk about another aspect of the ARPA money.
Yeah. Thank you. I just want to share bureaucratic quagmire that our town got into, and I'm sure other towns will, because the intergovernmental relations is kind of our charge. And it's related to school indoor air quality. So Lon, listen up. The governor has stated both at CCM meetings and Council of Small Towns meeting the need for improving indoor air quality in schools, especially older school buildings. Some of our more urban areas have, due to the high reimbursement rates, have constructed newer schools that have better air handling systems. But some of us have 60-year-old, 80-year-old school buildings, which have univentilators, traditional schools, systems that do very little for indoor air quality. So the governor's statements, which I'm sure he absolutely means and would stand by, are one thing. But what's not in the state plan for use of coronavirus state fiscal recovery fund is any money that goes to school air. So going through the traditional school construction grant program, which is funded by bonding, indoor air quality, IAQ, is covered. But DAS, who now runs that program, defers to the State Department of Public Health to declare what it is indoor air quality. So they haven't funded any projects in a number of years. and they are not going to fund any coronavirus projects because they say there are no standards for indoor air quality. The State Department of Public Health came out with Substitute Bill number 288, which has declared standards that the State Department of Public Health believes are appropriate for school air. It got joint favorable out of the Public Health Committee and then died, partly because they wanted to have gyms couldn't be over 85 degrees. So there's a problem. So right now, I'm asking whether we should look at, or whether it's appropriate even. So the first question is it appropriate that we look at asking that the governor's office looks at the allocations of their plan to see whether some money should go towards indoor air quality for schools. Short of that, even if there's like leftover money, because some of these funds won't be used, that it becomes a priority for the leftover money. But I've got a $6 million project, which I'm not so sure I'm going to get passed at a bond referendum, just to do two of my four schools, because they're old. It's frankly, what might be cheaper for us to throw the school out and build a new one, because the state would pay for that. So I don't believe that's the proper and sustainable thing for us to do, is to throw buildings out. Let's just get modern air systems in. So I don't know. I'm kind of throwing this out there going, this seems to be nobody has ownership. They're saying there's no regs. Another department wanted regs that are national standard regs by the engineering associations. They're actually adopted in the state building code. But at this point, there's no state money for school air. So is that this jurisdiction, or I've already brought in CCM and cost into these issues, had some, discussions that, what use your local money, which we are, but the smaller towns don't get that much money for the federal government. So where do we go? And if this isn't this group's issue, fine. But I'm coming out of frustration because I see it. Everyone understands the need for it, and I think the state's afraid of paying for it.
Is the order of magnitude for replacement systems such that, an infusion of money from ARPA would cover you and the many other towns that might be facing the same problem? Or is it really more of a, is it an expensive problem that really requires state bonding to accommodate?
Yeah, so two buildings, $6.2 million for us.
Just for the air.
Hmm.
And are those buildings right now like pneumatically controlled, and you've got like steam boilers and?
No, we have modern boilers, and that was the first thing the state said is, well, you're not doing maintenance. These are just to replace the unit ventilators, that the typical hotel units, if you want to think of them like that go under the school windows. Those cannot support MERV 13. I'm sorry, I'm getting technical. Filters, which are the filters recommended for COVID, they can't push the air through there to filter. They weren't designed for that. The motors aren't strong enough. You'll burn the motors out, or you won't get enough indoor air quality. But beyond that, the schools weren't built with today's standard for fresh air and today's standards for exhaust and no treatment for COVID, basically. So, I already have parents saying, I'm not going to send my kids to your schools because they're built in the 60s and they don't comply. And again, we've maintained our boilers. We have brand new boilers, but they view the state's rulings right now, are they view this as maintenance. They'll replace a roof, which after 20 years, it's replacement. Mechanical system, HVAC, they don't view that as end of life. So they're all doing their job. I'm not being critical. And they're protecting the state, and they feel they're within it. But the statutes for school construction do say indoor air quality. But to them, that means Department help. It means you have a sudden outbreak of mold or asbestos blowing through the system. And typically means you got to abandon everybody and get them out and then you fix the building. But
John, could a solution be that that DAS change its position on this in light of what you're describing? I mean, would that be a solution that it would be eligible for school construction?
I've been trying to work through the governor's office to talk about that.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't feel comfortable with it because I think there's a fear of opening a door, and it could be huge. It could be huge amount of money, but it's going to be a huge amount of money no matter what. It's betting who pays. New formula, maximum, you know, max it out at say $1.5 million or $1 million per school, that you got to match it, that towns have to contribute their funds or a good share of their funds that we're getting from the federal government. But I think we need a solution here. And I think everyone's willing to talk about it, but right now they don't feel that based on the past practices, it's allowed.
Yeah. Is it, I think it's complete. I don't know. I'll speak for myself. I think it's completely appropriate for ACIR to be stepping in on this. Right. If not in the context of ARPA funding, or maybe there's a way to leverage a portion of the ARPA funding to help subsidize the state's investment on this. But it seems to me that this is more of a policy issue that needs to get reexamined than it is really about the money itself. And I think that is completely appropriate for us to be, making a statement, as a group or participating in a discussion or asking the governor and DAS to really engage on this. I don't know how other folks feel, but that seems to be squarely within our purview. Lon?
And this has been long been an issue. You know, we've been through a couple building processes in my neck of the woods. We had a whole overhaul of our HVAC system in our elementary school 1 year, and I can't remember if that was covered or not. I don't remember. It was a while ago. But a lot of towns often struggle with that question of is it less expensive to knock the building down and start over again as opposed to just renovating what you already have? And common sense would say renovate is better. They do have like the renovate is new standards and stuff, but I think in the era of COVID here, in lieu of a standard that everyone agrees on, you know, I think it's probably worth bringing this up. The problem is, who do you bring it up with? right. It's Department of Health. It's Department of Ed. I know the building group is in the Department of Ed for the reimbursements, but.
No, it's actually moved to DAS now.
Oh, now it's a DAS now. Okay. It's been a while since we had something at my school. but it, I think it's worth discussing because a lot of communities are going to be looking at air quality because the public.
Right. In a COVID context. John, in your meetings that you have had with the governor's office, have all the folks been involved? Have public health and DAS?
That was just a starting meeting. So it was just CCM Cost and the rep of the governor's office. I have had some talks directly with the head of school construction and DAS related to other issues and this issue, Costa.
Yeah.
Nice. Again, doing his job. I'm not trying to get anyone in trouble here. They're all doing
what they have
always done and what's appropriate. But I think COVID and maybe a pot of money here that's being looked at being allocated could be considered. I get it that they're doing the responsible thing of looking at not overloading the bonding schedule of the state. But I think this is different.
Yeah.
And I think if I remember correctly from the guidance from the state in regards to air quality for COVID, you know, it was do the best that you can. And they had recommendations for fan speed but I don't think there was any concrete advice on filter strength other than recommendations on the type of filter, as you mentioned, right? But they for the opening last year, I recall it just being guidelines on how hard to run the fan system to try to keep as much airflow as possible, but they didn't really stipulate a standard.
Yeah. So again, the State Department of Public Health and Substitute Bill 288 proposed a standard. So they think they know what they want. It just didn't make it through the legislature, but
right. So we're still right. Where we're.
Okay. Margaret.
I think this is something that's related to COVID, and in the town of Weston, which doesn't get any money, of course, from anybody anyway, but, we have a very good building committee with real specialists on it, volunteer, you know, they're there. And so that they come in with guidance to the Board of Ed and whatever, but they're very knowledgeable. So, you know, you try to get by with the best you can, but not everybody is Weston, you know, so there has to be some help, I think, yeah. If you want to get rid of COVID.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks, Margaret. Martin, as our resident member of the committee, but also administration whisperer, can we pull something together on this, do you think? Is it, would I call on you, or should I call the governor's office perhaps on behalf of ACIR to see if we can pull something together more? It's a little more robust.
I'm not sure who's on the team on that side. I mean, for that, but I'd suggest, I mean, I'm happy to work with you, Brendan. We can figure out the right people to contact going through this. I know some of it went through OPM with the secretary and the governor as they did the, you know, capital plan. So it's kind of going through them, you know, overall to go through it. So we can definitely get the connections there to, you know, work something up and, you know, make a recommendation to them or, you know, talk with them about it.
Great. Okay. Well, as is always the case with ACIR, these ACIR meetings, we wind up the meeting with more assignments than we had coming in. So this will be something I'll connect up with you, Martin and John and Lon, if you're interested in participating in this, and we can take it from there. I don't know if anybody else is interested. Jim?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask the question. I'm wondering if you or Lon perhaps could check in with the Department of Education and see if at this point they've received sort of a preview from municipalities in terms of projected costs that they might be aware of out there. So you'd sort of get at least a notion. I would imagine that the school systems have been reporting their needs to the Department of Education. Maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like
sure.
We would.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Find out what that number is, and even if it's just a very preliminary number, it would be something to start with in terms of kind of getting a handle on what this means.
Agreed.
And I think that's the crux of it is that unless you've hired a mechanical engineer already, you really don't know. And the school districts under a lot of the towns did get money and school districts got money. But again, smaller towns wasn't tremendously amount of money. And our local school district, reading the guidance from the state, is spending their money not on HVAC, but on catching up to learn, which was a real state priority for that. So HVAC is eligible, but they feel they have to spend the money there. And to put it in perspective, our school district's getting $360,000. So that doesn't go too far towards $6.2 million.
Sure. Everything. And by the way, the other issue that I do anticipate is going to be a lot of maintenance items related to these HVAC systems running a lot harder than they had ever run. Yeah. Again, what they wanted for us, I remember going through the checklist, they wanted that fan running at, 80% or whatever, 3 hours before the kids come in, to have all the air cleared out of the building before they even walked in the door. So I know we've been running ours a lot harder than we've ever run them.
And the old motors are burning out.
Oh yeah. Yep. And then if anyone installed those filters, the filter can fit into one of those spots. And that was actually a big consideration was, what kind of strain will that add to the system and potentially, damage those that have been in place. So there's gonna be a lot of that, I think, in the next year or two.
Right. Right.
So, Jim, I think your point's very valid. I just don't know if districts, you can ask them, but I don't know if they have any clue. I mean, I think that's where some very smart engineers could come up with, based on the type of system, what a typical cost per square foot estimate would be.
Good. Okay. All right. We'll add that to a list of things that we need to get done in the next couple of weeks. So, Martin, I'll be reaching out to you for you know, time, maybe we can all get on a call initially and then start developing the plan on that, if that makes sense. Thanks, John, for that. So we're kind of moving on. I know we have an item regarding plans for the 22 legislative session. I think Bruce puts that on our agenda to keep us mindful of the fact that there, as we build up a list of recommendations for next year, time goes by very quickly, and we need to be mindful of the fact that if there are going to be recommendations coming in that we're going to be making for 22, we need to kind of have that list together, you know, by November or so at the very latest. So be thinking about that. I'm going to move on if I could. Just looking
Brandon,
at the
just clock. One mention of that with legislative session is that all state agencies have been asked to get their proposals in by October 1st.
Oh.
So it is, you know, to OPM, you know, obviously as we do our review piece and everything else, but all agencies, we work on October 1st, not November, not to say that things can't come in later, but obviously the sooner, the better.
Yeah. Thank you for that. That's a point well taken. So moving on to new business, there are a couple of things I did want to raise. One is a question of whether we would like to consider our meetings to be held in person back at the Legislative Office Building versus exclusively online. I've reached out to Legislative Management about this, and we're perfectly welcome to come. The way the Legislative Office Building is working these days is that the first floor is the only area of the building that is accessible to members of the public, which is fine for us because we typically take a committee room on the first floor. And they also have the ability to allow meetings that are hybrid, so folks can participate remotely as well as in person. And so I wanted to take the temperature of the group to see if that's something you're interested in doing. If, you know, maybe our September meeting might be held in a virtual setting at the LOB, or whether you'd like to maintain it as we have it now in a totally virtual. What's your thought? Lyle, yeah.
Yep, I'm a little skittish given the COVID variant uncertainty on this. We have slowed down our mandatory return to work for everybody, as have many major employers. So I guess I would, I guess my personal view would be expressing a note of caution that we do it a month later, just to make sure we're not stepping into something that would be inappropriate. Because if we have to be masked up and, you know, distant and et cetera, you know, it kind of takes away from the in-person situation. But given the COVID variant and the fact that we're over 3% positivity and kind of bouncing around, my suggestion is I think it's a good idea, but I would maybe move it back a month. Just to suggest, that's my two cents. So that's one
view. I understand. Yeah. And I do want to note the irony that we're also tasked with the responsibility of advising the legislature on local meetings, remote, other and otherwise. So that's actually part of our own responsibility to to look into this very topic. And the question is whether we want to do it ourselves. Yeah.
So
thanks for that.
So yeah. It might make sense to have hybrid. That's part of the question, I think, going forward for ACIR, for the state as a whole, is whether or not we can get greater participation by having hybrid, but allow the opportunity for individuals to attend in person. And you know, Lyle's right, we're kind of an odd, awkward, if you will, situation right now that hopefully plays out better than we think maybe it will. Anyway, that's my thought on it.
Yeah, Jim, thanks,
Bob. I agree with Lyle. I think I would be comfortable postponing the decision until we know more about the Delta variant. But I also agree with Bob that the hybrid solution works very well for me. And I think I've noted, for example, with regard to our quorum attendance, it seems as though we've had much better attendance since we've been doing this virtually. So I think if you do the hybrid, people who are easily able to go to the legislative office building, that's great. And that would be great for camaraderie. But folks who are, an hour and 40 minutes away or so wouldn't have to make that trip in order to make the meetings. And, in the past, I can remember a number of meetings that we've attended where we drive all the way into Hartford and then find out that there isn't a quorum. And so sort of left with that. So at any rate, hybrid works for me going forward permanently.
But let me put you on the spot. Are you thinking for next month, or do you recommend maybe pushing it off a month and seeing where we are?
I recommend pushing it off for a month, unless, there may be some who feel really comfortable, but I'd push it off for a month.
Okay. John?
I tend to agree with Lyle, and I'd also be curious if the issue that John earlier brought up about air quality. I've never been happy with the air quality in some of those hearing rooms. As somebody who suffers from allergies, it always, to me, has never been great. So I think until this, we get some clarity on the Delta and what we're hearing that with the viral loads and so forth, I think we need to proceed with a lot of caution.
Okay, fair enough. Rick, I think you had your hand up if you wanted to weigh in on that.
I have to agree with Jim and Lyle and John. I think it would be prudent to put it off a month because we don't know what's going to happen. I mean, they may end up shutting the LOB down again just as a result. So I think it would be prudent to hold off until October.
Okay. Anyone else? That seems to be the consensus, but does anybody else feel strongly otherwise? We'll revisit it next month, see where we are. Okay, good. All right. Thank you all for that. And the only other item under, maybe it's under new business or maybe moving on to other municipal, regional, or state matters. The governor yesterday, as you know, issued Executive Order 13A, which empowers municipal officials to make their own decisions about masking requirements. Are there any comments or thoughts on that as far as we're concerned or issues that might be relevant for us to take a look at or think about?
The only thing I would say with that is just that, this has been a real test of almost back to the local control issue is as opposed to what this decision is, who makes the decision? Because that's one thing we're struggling with right now on the school side, because we don't know as boards of education, what our authority will be vis-a-vis masking right now. We know there's an executive order that goes to the end of September, but we're not certain as board members whether or not we're making the call or somebody else is. So I think this is an example of when you have a number of departments that have the authority to make recommendations or actual authority to make a mandate, a lot of times we don't know as local officials what our role is going to be. And I think that sets the public expectation in a way that makes it difficult. And, we're at August 6th. A lot of schools are opening up in 2 or 3 weeks, and we still don't know what we can or can't do.
So our town attorney says that the town doesn't have authority over the schools, which is interesting because the executive order is absolutely silent on that. So I can tell a supermarket that you have to mask up, but I can't tell a school that you have to mask up,
right.
Which yeah. I really don't want to.
Yeah. Marcia?
I did a quick read of the new executive order, and I thought it just went in circles. And quite frankly, I thought it only allowed the municipality to control its buildings and its property. Although what I'm reading is a little different. So I had to pass it along to our corporation council to do an interpretation on that. But, COVID doesn't know boundaries. It doesn't know municipal boundaries. And I'm concerned that we don't have an overarching plan in place for the state. So that's I have people that live in my community that travel, you know, down the other end of the state for work. So I'm baffled by the inability that there isn't a state mandate.
Boy, and everybody's got a something. Martin, I know you had. I think you, Martin, you thought we're thinking of.
So I just added into the chat that schools are still under Executive Order 9, Section 1. And under EO 13A as well for mask mandates for school. And that's just information that came from Office of the Governor, which Cost just sent out an email blast on that we were in communications last night with some FAQ questions, everything. They kind of compiled it all in. But if anyone doesn't have it or is not on the Cost email list, I know it also, all this information went to CCM as well. And the municipal attorney group to get out to everybody with some FAQs, which the governor's attorney's office, you know, went through on it. But I just popped in the mask mandate in school section from that email blast.
And Martin, that's until the 30th of September. Is that right?
Correct.
And I think what now is at a CABE event yesterday, and there was a lot of concern in the room going into the meeting, and the commissioner was there, Commissioner of Education was there, and said it might change before the 30th. You know, so that's leading to a lot of anxiety amongst board members. You know, not that I think we're afraid of making decisions, just that we don't know whose decision.
Who has the authority, right?
Yeah, so I mentioned to the commissioner that, you know, look, we don't need you to make a decision. Just tell us who's making the decision. And I think that'll help us get to the end of this, because it's going to be a much more complicated opening in some ways. We know what we're up against, but it'd just be good to know what we can and can't do. And we may have impact negotiations as a result of what authorities we do get.
Right. Other comments? Jim? You're muted, Jim.
As far as I know, we're still operating with the commissioner of the Department of Public Health being the incident commander for this incident, the COVID incident. You know, if we follow along with that, then the guidance should be coming from directly from the Department of Health. You know, they may want to put parameters on it in terms of perhaps local parameters that this school districts or the departments of public health would follow. But it seems to me an abandonment of their role as incident command if they don't come forth with actual a statement as to what they expect from all of the school systems.
And I you know, I think I hear from the group the, you know, the sense of confusion and frustration because about the confusion, but I'm wondering, I just with an eye towards the clock as well as towards our mission, does the group feel that there is a role that ACIR can play in terms of facilitating the clarity on this, or are we feeling as though, you know, we're raising the question among ourselves, but it, you know, perhaps it's better resolved by the governor's office and the other, you know, relevant stakeholders in the discussion? Is there something we can do, you know, as ACIR on this, or should do?
Brendan, if I could, it seems to me that the governor's office is in a very difficult position in this whole subject. We have CDC who is offering guidance, and then we have other guidances that have been put forward by the Department of Health in the state of Connecticut. I think what the governor, the way I interpret it, what the governor did yesterday was to make clear that chief elected officials within a municipality have the ability to determine whether or not their buildings have the requirement of masks or not. Anyway, I'll leave it at that because our noon siren's going off and drown me out.
There we are. There we are in Goshen. Does that happen to you often, Bob? Or is that just a notice saying that our meeting time is over?
That's the lunch.
Siren sits over top of my office.
Oh. I would just say that I think this actually falls into our discussion about local control and home rule, right? The governor said, hey, in this case, it's a local decision. It kind of makes sense in some ways because every town is experiencing different levels of vaccination and and infection rate. And I think it's interesting because the schools are kind of a different entity with different, you know, people don't have the option this year of not going to school, as far as we know. So, you know, that creates a greater need to protect more vulnerable populations from transmission. So, you know, but I think that the notion of local control is quite evident with this topic, which is something unusual for towns to deal with.
And, and if I could just add in that, you know, I declared a public health emergency, so I thought I already had this type of power.
Well, you had it until the governor took it away, and now you have it again. So anyway, it's always what I was going to finish is say is that it's always a catch 22 for the governor's office. You know, we as chief elected officials claim that we don't have the authority that we want. But then when he gives us the authority, we claim, well, why should we make this decision? It should be made for the state as a whole. And that puts me off the hook. So I personally don't have a problem with it. When it comes time, I'll pull that trigger. But I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Good. All right, good. So, but I hear that it's not necessarily a role other than in the broader context of local control versus home rule and all that, that there's not really necessarily a role right now immediately for ACIR to play.
There may be a role if this thing deteriorates further. But, you know, right now, I'm not sure. My preference is for consistency and not have 169 variations on a theme, but not everybody agrees with that.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on that, on this as it goes forward. And hopefully if it doesn't devolve into a total mess, then hopefully folks like Martin will be able to take care of it for us. Thanks, Martin. No pressure. Okay. Any other public comments or comments from the group or from the public who's observing? Not seeing any. And if that's the case, then just to alert you to the next Local Government in the Future subcommittee meeting is Tuesday, August 24th at 10:30. I may have a conflict personally with that particular time, and we can decide how we want to handle that as we go forward. But Bruce, I'll just giving you a heads up about that. And then our next full ACIR meeting will be Friday, September 10th, which is the second Friday of the month, as opposed to our usual first Friday, because the first Friday is the Friday before Labor Day weekend. So we usually roll it over into the second Friday when that occurs. So with that, I'll unless there's any other input from folks, Lyle?
Motion to adjourn.
I will second that.
Second from Valentine. All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay, if it's unanimous. Thank you all. Enjoy these weeks of summer that you have left. Beautiful day today. And we got a lot of work to do, so we'll see you next month. Thanks.
Thanks, everybody.
Stay healthy.